This is Connor McPherson. I'm the Chief Marketing Officer at OBL Marketing. Our team works with doctors all over the country to help them bring in more new qualified patients. We can help you build your website or fix your current one. We help practices manage their reviews and get more 5 stars on Google and health grades. And most important, we get you in front of more potential patients by helping them find you when they're searching and doing research online for treatments. We help grow some of the most successful practices in the country with a results-oriented, direct-to-patient marketing strategy that gives you an actual return on your investment. You can go and check out our website for more info as well. It's oblmarketing.com. We've got some great stuff on there, case studies and reviews from our docs who love working with us. And you can give me a call or shoot me an email to set up a 15-minute marketing analysis. I'll take a look at your website. I'll take a look at your online presence and talk with you about your marketing strategy to see where it can be improved. If you're wanting to do more UFE cases, GAE, PAE, PAD, veins, you name it, we know your industry, we know what it takes to win online, and we know how to make your practice grow. If you're already running your own practice or you're thinking about starting one, we want to help you. Go to oblmarketing.com. Let's take 15 minutes to see how we can help. That's oblmarketing.com.
This week on the Backtable Podcast.
What was amazing to me, Allie, is nobody knew what an interventional radiologist was. Nobody. Not one single insurance company.
Are you surprised, really?
Well, I'm not surprised, but at the same time, they should have some awareness because they're the ones paying. But
sure,
they did not know the difference between IR and diagnostic radiology. When I did have the meeting, some of them were confused. They were like, why are you even calling for a meeting with us? And why are E&M codes important to you? It's not like you see patients. So right there, I had to start at the very beginning and educate them on what interventional radiology is in 5 minutes.
Welcome to the Backtable Podcast, your source for all things interventional and endovascular. You can find all previous episodes of our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and on Backtable.com. Now, a quick word from our sponsor.
Greetings to our esteemed IR community. Picture a future where cutting-edge interventional technologies are seamlessly integrated with world-class imaging tools that are designed to reshape procedural efficiency, enhance precision, and foster patient-centered care in interventional radiology. Because that's our vision at Varian. And we're working with partners across Siemens Healthineers to bring it to life. What sets our Imbazine and Oncozine microspheres apart? Features that enhance procedural and cost efficiency, like precise calibration and syringes that contain more microspheres per volume, which means fewer syringes per procedure. And Imbazine microspheres offer a broad spectrum of 10 sizes, each identified by distinctive colors, facilitating visualization of suspension. This streamlines the process and also minimizes the potential for errors. So experience the future of interventional radiology with Varian. Check out our innovative solutions at varian.com/interventional. Varian, a Siemens Healthineers company, we pioneer breakthroughs in healthcare for everyone, everywhere, sustainably.
This episode is supported by Reflow Medical. When an interventionalist approaches a case, they need to have an unwavering confidence in the tools they're about to use. That's why leading physicians rely on medical devices by Reflow. The Wingman for rapid CTO crossing, the Specs LP, a low-profile catheter you can shape to the preferred angle for improved vascular access and crossing, core catheters, a suite of effective tools for use in complex PCI procedures. It's all about finding solutions to unmet clinical needs. For more information, visit reflowmedical.com.
And now back to the show.
I'm your host, Dr. Allie Behetti. I'm coming to you from Tacoma, Washington. And today, I have the pleasure of welcoming two very special guests, Dr. Deepak Sudhendra, as well as Lori Buzarellos. And our topic today is going to be insurance contracting in the OBL. Deepak, Lori, thanks for coming on the show.
Yes, thank you for having us, Allie.
Thank you for having us.
Let's get started. How did you two get introduced?
Well, we were actually introduced through a common acquaintance, a colleague, and I was talking to my colleague about insurance contracting. I was just about to start the process, and she said, oh, I have someone who may be able to give you just a few tips, and she introduced me to Lori, and that's led to a 2-year relationship already.
Awesome. And Lori, could you give me a little bit of background about your company and what your role is with insurance contracting?
Yeah, absolutely. I started my own small business in February of 2020, a challenging year to start a business, as many other people found as well. But with 4 years under my belt now, I have really narrowed my focus to working with private practice physicians and physician business owners. So that's kind of a niche. Most of them are small business owners, some of them small solo practices. But my approach is focused on education, teaching business owners what they need to understand about the revenue cycle, with payer contracting being really the most important, the most critical piece of that work. And it's everyone's paycheck. So a lot of times that work isn't prioritized when people are starting a new business, and yet it's your only lever for income. It really needs the most focus, especially in the early years.
Yeah, I think Deepak, you and I have had conversations about this and how you're so excited to get your business up and running that maybe you don't spend a ton of time working on your insurance contracts. Want to speak a little bit about your experience in looking into insurance contracts?
Yeah, I think that my view on insurance contracts was really that of an amateur. I've been a hospital employed my entire career, and now I was leaving the academic center to start my own practice. And you really think, oh, how hard can this be? I just fill out some paperwork for United or Blue Cross and I submit it and they'll issue me a contract. Well, Ali, I actually started the process in August of 22 is when I started putting my first applications. And I just finished my last insurance company right before Christmas as far as getting a contract. So it took me about 16 months to get on the insurance plans. And my OBL opened in August of last year. And when it opened, I was only on Medicare, Medicaid, and United. That was it.
I see. Yeah. Lori, would you say the time frame is pretty average for doctors when they're trying to get on an insurance plan?
I would say it's very typical, especially for a small group. If you're interested in taking opening offers and not negotiating any of the terms or any of the reimbursement, you can be signed up very quickly. But if you're interested in really taking a long view and taking the time to make sure you maximize where you come in at the very beginning of your business, of your practice, it's going to take a lot of time. And I tell people 1 to 2 years, depending on how many contracts we do. So one of the important things in the beginning that I recommend people do is, and what I do with my clients, is that we begin with a managed care strategy. So we look at the market, we talk to one another about what's important to them about their practice. Is the most important thing access for everyone, certain referral channels, important businesses in the community, the biggest market share? Everyone has different goals and priorities with their business. So we set that managed care strategy unique to that practice, and then we tier the payers to tier one, tier two, tier three. And in our first year together, we're going to focus only on those tier one payers that are most important to the practice.
So speak to me a little bit about the different tiers of payers that you just described.
So with a new practice where we don't have data, we don't have information about your market share or your payer mix, we would look at the market information provided through the Department of Insurance or through the Kaiser Family Foundation. There's different publicly available sources to understand market share. You can also look at your hospitals in your community and a lot of different sources. So we would look at those kinds of factors, and we would also weigh them with the types of services the provider is going to be offering. So if Medicare is really important to the practice, who are the big Medicare and Medicare Advantage providers in the community if that's going to be part of the business model?
I see. Okay. And then you just try and prioritize those.
And we prioritize those. So we're going to start on the ones that have a lot of market share, the insurance companies that are most important in the community. So if Blue Cross has 30% of the market, we're going to focus a lot of time and effort on building a relationship with Blue Cross, understanding what the market can bear and getting the best rates we can, because we know that's probably going to be about 30% of the money that's coming into the practice. So it's going to be a really important part of the business.
So Deepak, I know when you started doing insurance contracts, you were doing them on your own. But at what point did you stop and say, hey, I really need to get a professional involved in this. This is too much for me to take on?
It was really pretty early on. I think it was probably within the first 3 or 4 months that I was not hearing anything from the insurance companies. And Medicare and Medicaid is quite easy to get on, but it was the private insurance companies. Mm-hmm. And during that 3 to 4 months, I was introduced to Lori. And I started kind of doing my homework to interview other potential companies that assist physicians in securing contracts. And one of the conversations that really struck home that I had with Lori was she told me, look, as you interview other companies, ask them what it is that they are going to do for you. How are they going to go to bat for you and get that good contract with an insurance company? And perhaps even ask them, can you listen on the phone? Are they calling the insurance company and are they bragging about you, so to speak? And can you just sort of listen and be quiet? And I asked a few of the companies and they said, absolutely not. This is, doc, just trust us. We've been doing this for a long time. We have a lot more experience than the average physician. So don't worry, you're in good hands. And I think that actually brings us to a very good question, I think, for Lori, is the differences that I found between her approach and others like her versus many of the other companies that are out there, because she takes a different approach.
Yeah, go ahead and speak to that if you don't mind.
Sure. When I set up a payer engagement with a new client, I use a coaching model. So a coaching model is I am preparing the physician to represent themselves. So they're actually the direct communicator with the payer throughout the engagement. I am not that communicator. So I am teaching them about their contracts. I'm teaching them how to read a contract, how to understand the terms, meaning the words, the verbiage, how to understand their obligations under those agreements, what parts might be negotiable. If we cannot get language changed, what does that mean for them? What do they need to understand? What do they need to do in their day-to-day operation to be in compliance? And then ultimately, understanding that reimbursement. What does the payment model mean? And negotiating that payment so to make absolutely sure that the codes that are most important to that physician's practice, to their livelihood, to their business, that we get those negotiated to the highest rate possible. And we go back and forth for a long time. So we can speak a little bit about the market and how we get some market information. But the most important thing that is different is that I am teaching the physician how to advocate for their business. I am teaching them to understand these inputs, this lever, this contract, their income, their paycheck, and why it's so important to their long-term success of their business. So I'm not on the phone doing this work for them. They're doing the work. I'm doing the analytics. I'm reviewing contracts with them, helping them understand it, but I'm not the face of the negotiations. Physicians are.
Interesting. Okay. So describe to me the basic process of contracting with insurance.
So when we get started, I think the terminology or the vocabulary around contracting gets a little bit muddled. And if we could just take a minute to review some of those basic terms. And we throw around the term credentialing a lot, but really our first relationship with a payer is enrollment. You're getting enrolled. You're signing up. You're developing a relationship with them. And then they are doing the credentialing. So the insurance company is actually taking your information and validating it. And that is the process of credentialing. Did Dr. Sudhindra actually do a fellowship? Are you licensed in the state of Ohio or whatever state you're in? That's the process of credentialing, validating that information. And then the payer will give you a contract. So you've enrolled, they've credentialed you, and they say, sure, we'd like to have you in our network. Here's a contract. Then the work begins to really take that contract and understand the terms and the reimbursement and what you need to do to live under those terms and to negotiate that. So the timeline Dr. spoke to in the beginning, it is a long and tedious process. And I think Dr. Sudhi could speak a little bit about even the timeline perceptions when you first started and some of the barriers you faced that I think people don't often acknowledge or recognize.
Yeah, people told me that it would take anywhere from 6 to 9 months, maybe a year to get on certain plans. And as I said, when all is said and done, it was about 16 months. And one of the things that I was really surprised at was the number of doors that closed in my face from every major insurance company. I got an automated email from every commercial insurer saying, Dr. Sudhi, thank you for your application to be on our physician panel. There are too many physicians in Central Ohio. We do not need your services. We wish you the best of luck. Please do not reply to this email. This mailbox is not monitored. And there is no one to talk to. There is no phone number to call. When you do call, they say, well, what is your account number or your whatever ID number with us? And you say, well, I don't have one. And they're like, click, goodbye. So it's really very difficult. And I was really getting scared, I'll be honest. My OBL, the construction was nearing completion. And I was like, oh my God, I'm only on Medicare and Medicaid. Already, I am looking at bankruptcy because there is no way I will ever be able to keep an OBL open only taking Medicare and Medicaid.
Oh man, yeah, I can see you looking down that barrel and being really stressed out about it. So what do you do once they close all those doors?
Well, you panic a little bit and then you just keep knocking on more and more doors. And I would reach out to the different people in the insurance company. I spent a lot of time on Google and LinkedIn. I would type in contracting supervisor Anthem and then try it for United. And then you would get several people. And then some people haven't updated their LinkedIn profiles or the email is wrong. And it was just a lot of doing research and sending emails to people, asking them to call me and, you know, please reply. I haven't heard anything. And some people would steer me in the right direction. You know, one person said, I'm not in that division anymore. You may want to try this person. So I think it requires just a lot of tenacity, determination, and you just have to keep going. I think one of the things that is different in my situation is most people who open up an OBL, they do it in the town that they've been practicing. They have established a practice. They may be working for an academic center or a big health system or whatever, community hospital. And then they say, you know what? I'm going to go out on my own. And they already have insurance contracts. They may or may not be able to take those insurance contracts with them. That depends. But at least they're sort of known in the community and the insurers may be familiar with them. In my case, it was very different. I moved to a completely different state where nobody knows me and set up a practice.
Right, right. Yeah, no, definitely a different set of challenges with that. Lori, do you think we've covered kind of the basics of contracting and terms and the process?
Yeah, I think we have.
Okay. So basically, you submit all your stuff, you get credentialed, they send you kind of an opening gambit. And then what do you usually see on that opening bid from the insurance company where you're like, oh, we can probably get that changed. We probably get that changed. That's probably set in stone. That I don't think I can do anything about.
When we start looking at the very beginning, your agreement defines things like your timely filing limit and how member billing, under what circumstances you can bill the member. There's different terms and language. Sometimes those are overridden by a state amendment. So in the back, there's going to be an attachment where every contract has to abide by state laws that may be more stringent or different than what they have in their standard contract. Sometimes the state, if they have a strong physician lobbying organization, they've lobbied and have some protective language in the state amendment that protects the physician. One of the things I like to recommend is that physicians have contracts that can be changed by mutual written agreement only. And typically the language in an agreement that comes forward says they can change the contract with, it depends on the state, but 30 days notice, 60, 90 days, somewhere in there, unless you object in writing. And if you object in writing, often the language indicates that you have to terminate. So they won't always terminate you, but a lot of times these material change notices or notice of material change is often the heading that changes how you are compensated by the payer. These come through in the office and people miss them and they don't object to it or they don't analyze it or they don't respond. So having that language where they can only change your contract, your relationship with a signature by both parties, mutual written agreement. So, and one of the things I should have clarified in the introductions, I apologize, I am not an attorney and I don't employ attorneys on my team, but I work collaboratively with the physician's attorney. So whoever the physician retains as general counsel that advocates for them in their practice, I will work collaboratively with that person. So I'm, again, not representing anyone in a legal sense, but we work through a lot of these terms and the impact they have on the income of the practice, understanding that from an education, a learning position. So I just wanted to add that and make that clear.
Have you seen a trend in the private insurance giving like a percentage over Medicare? And I know they obviously lowball it usually, right? But what have you seen recently as the trends for what private insurance offers as their opening gambit?
There are a lot of regional differences. I think physicians in different states are really facing different market challenges that aren't always like necessarily, I wouldn't see them as totally comparable to the cost of living where they are. We tend to see in states with a high proportion of Medicare enrollees, where you're looking in the South, Florida, Arizona, Texas, you really see the market is fairly competitive. Like the reimbursement rates are very low. We see some very strong reimbursement rates available in the Midwest and often on the coast, but not always. So there are regional differences. But again, starting to get a feel for the competitive information can really, really help you take that opening offer and then decide where you want to land. Where are we going to end up? I would never recommend to anyone to take anything below Medicare. Like seeing Medicare as a floor, we'd like to have you well, well, well above Medicare. And if we could talk a little bit about some of the changes that Health Price Transparency and Healthcare Act has brought, we actually have more information now than we've ever had before.
So you've gotten back your first offer. How do you evaluate whether or not it's a good offer?
That's a great question, Allie. Thank you. So we've had some changes, actually have more information now than we've ever had before, that have happened in recent years with price transparency in healthcare. I know for physicians in general, there's been a lot of negative repercussions for that. But one of the positives that came out of it is that payers in July of 2022 had to start releasing every negotiated rate across the country by NPI. But insurance companies have a very strong lobbying organization, and the way that that data, it's a massive amount of information, and the way that information releases is in machine-readable files that you or I would crash our computers if we tried to open them. So you could look it up, you could find it, but there's no way to read it. Like, it's not accessible to you and I. But we have seen data science companies pop up and take advantage of this new information and help people access it. And that's something really fun that I've added to my business this year that I've just found to be amazing. And you can actually put in, so we write queries that pull NPI data for a market. So we work with the practice, pull the NPI information, and the data science company I work with, they're really refining how they align that information. Payers are mostly not in compliance. We might ask for 50 NPIs and get 9 back. But there's no enforcement yet. So it's coming. But, you know, at this point in time, mostly they're just the compliance isn't there, but you still can get valuable information. And just even seeing what they're reporting for your own NPI as the contracted rates and do they match your contract? But there's also the hospitals had to start posting their market information well before the payers did, which is too bad. It should have been the other way around. That's personal bias. But when we started Dr. Sudi's practice, we were using that competitive information available through the hospitals. And he worked really hard. He did a lot of the groundwork in our engagement himself because of where he was at in his practice. So just by getting on the internet and researching that posted data that hospitals have put in, and then we took it and put it into spreadsheets and you created some analytical tools to say, okay, this is where the hospitals are. This is where we need to be. And we're doing the same thing with that HEXI data. We create spreadsheet models that help us say, okay, the highest person that came back on this report was at 320% of 2023 Medicare, and the lowest person was at 102. You know, that's a huge spread, but it's one example, one CPT code. So you take that for your most important CPT codes. I use a data-driven approach. So we take the CPT codes that are most important to the practice, and we see where they're coming in the market, whether we're using hospital data or we're using the HEXIQ data or data science information that we have purchased. So that kind of information, it's like we've never had it before. You used to be like, hey, did anyone go to this practice? Can we see your EOB? And we back calculate what they were getting on a 99305. You're trying to figure it out with your family and stuff. Like, I mean, we were doing crazy things like that before to like even see, well, what is the university getting? Or if you wanted to know like who your biggest payers were or your biggest groups were in the market, what's their leverage? Because we would expect them to be near the top.
So that is so interesting. So then you can take that information and show it to the insurance companies. And then do you just like lowball it a little bit and be like, well, you can pay me this much and it's like 10% less? Or do you say, hey, this is like what the market standard is. I want to have that too.
I would actually say we use that information to just refine our ask, to really refine what we want to ask. And then I put it in the physician's hands to articulate what is unique about them. What can they do for this payer and why are they worth this amount of money? We actually don't say, well, you're paying Dr. Smith down the road here 102%. And this one, we use it to inform what we think we're worth and to make a good case for why we should be at this level of reimbursement, why the physician should be at this level of reimbursement. And then that's one of the things where in a coaching model, the physician's the face of the negotiation. They're talking to these people. I am assisting them with analytics. I'm assisting them with what's important. I'm assisting them with understanding the terms of their agreement, but they're the face of it. And they're the ones selling themselves and selling their business and why they're an important asset to this payer network. And the physicians can speak to that with a passion and an accuracy that I can't. I mean, there's just no way. And it's also hard for them to look a physician in the eye and say, oh, you're not worth 120% of Medicare. They don't want to say that. Nobody wants to say that. They want their doctor on their side.
Deepak, this might be a good transition to talk a little bit about kind of the boots on the ground work that you did to help show insurance companies the value of an OBL. What did you like to speak about that experience?
Yeah, Ali, I think one thing we should talk about, the whole, I don't know how to ask it, but maybe something about the whole concept of negotiating. I made a post about this on the private physician Facebook group, and the number of physicians who wrote back who are like, what do you mean you negotiated? You can't negotiate. Like, but people just thought I was nuts. They're like, why are you even bothering? And I think that's something very important to discuss because many people don't know that you can even negotiate. They just, it's, you get what you get.
Well, I think probably what I've been told at least is, you know, insurance companies don't even have to put you in network. So what is the point of you trying to negotiate? Because they're just going to drop you. What do you have to say to that?
Yeah, I think that when it comes to negotiating, one of the things that I had to really sit back and think, you read about the health systems potentially dropping an insurer because, you know, they're not getting paid. And you'll hear that they're in negotiations. That's sort of the standard line. So I said, well, if all these health systems are negotiating, then that means you can negotiate with an insurance company. Obviously, a big health system has much more leverage than a single person. But the concept of leveraging and negotiating exists. And the one thing I've learned through this process is there is nothing on this earth that is not negotiable. Nothing is fixed in stone. I mean, you're probably not going to go to the grocery store and argue the price of a banana, but most big purchases, you know, your car, you know, and everything, we negotiate. So why is it that something that is so important to our financial future and our business's financial future, many of us don't even read the contract. We just sign. We're so happy that we got the contract. We don't understand the contract, don't look at it, and we just sign, not knowing that it says 80% of Medicare, 70% of Medicare. And you pretty much have one shot to negotiate. So I think that has to be taken advantage of. The worst that any company will say is no.
So what's the most effective way to negotiate a change from your contract before you sign it?
One, I think the biggest thing is really educating the insurance company as to why you are special. Why are you special in your field? Why are you unique compared to the other person in the same specialty down the street? And how do you do that in a diplomatic way? And without disparaging anybody, you don't want to say, oh, Dr. Smith down the street is not a very good physician and I'm better than he or she. Nobody wants to hear that. So you want to do it in a very diplomatic way. And the one thing with a lot of these companies that you could hire that I wasn't really thrilled about when I spoke to them is I asked them, how are they going to
brag about me to the insurance company because they don't know me. None of them have ever met me in person. You're lucky if you get a Zoom call. It's usually an email or just a phone call. So they don't know me. And yet I have to pay them $8,000-$10,000 or more to negotiate on my behalf. And they are negotiating my financial future. So the insurance company already gives us our financial future. They dictate our salaries. So now to put another company as the middleman, add another layer, I really started to think, rather than pay $10,000 to a company, why don't I pay $10,000 to my mom? Let my mom do the negotiating. I mean, she's going to brag about her son all day long. She will use all the eloquent terms. I think we should all get our parents to do it rather than another company. And yeah, obviously, I'm being facetious, but the point is, this is the time to brag. And physicians, we don't like to do that. But this is where you have to pull out everything. It's like writing your profile. You want your profile to sound really good. So here, you want the insurance company to know what you're all about. And what I did find is what was amazing to me, Ellie, is nobody knew what an interventional radiologist was. Nobody. Not one single insurance company.
Are you surprised, really?
Well, I'm not surprised, but at the same time, they should have some awareness because they're the ones paying. But
sure,
they did not know the difference between IR and diagnostic radiology. When I did have the meeting, some of them were confused. They were like, why are you even calling for a meeting with us? And why are E&M codes important to you? It's not like you see patients. So right there, I had to start at the very beginning and educate them on what interventional radiology is in 5 minutes. I had 30 minutes with them. So that's something that I had to do. And the other thing was educate them on what an OBL is. That was really surprising to me. There is not one company who knew what an OBL is. They didn't know what an ASC was either. I thought maybe they'll know ambulatory surgery center. They had no clue. No clue at all.
That's pretty interesting.
So we say that insurance companies like to pay less. They like outpatient medicine. All of that is good in theory, but the people who are making your contract and who are deciding your rates, they have no idea what outpatient medicine is. So how are they going to give you a good rate when they just think, oh, you're just some office practice who's asking for a higher rate?
Yeah, I mean, Lori, do you have anything you want to talk about with that?
Yeah, I think that is one of the most important things is that as a physician business owner, you can articulate what sets your practice apart. You can speak to your value proposition better than anyone else. The passion comes through, and talking about what you do to improve the patient experience and also focusing on how you'll save providers money. How are you going to be a more cost-effective solution in your place of service 11, your outpatient center, than you are if you're using ambulatory surgery center or if you're taking patients to the hospital or seeing them through the hospital. And one of the things I'd love to add is that I often encourage people to invite the insurance companies for a site visit. Come see my office. Come see what I'm doing. Come meet me in person. How can we work together? And I have never had anyone have that happen until Dr. Sudi. And I think everyone came to visit, right?
I got every insurer to come.
How did you do that?
I was a pest. I would not take a no for an answer. And I just told them how they were really letting their patient membership down. I said their patients look up to them to provide care. And I said, I'm unique in the kinds of things that I do and that there hasn't been anything like it here in the region for some of the things that I treat. So how can you deny patients this? It costs you nothing other than some time to come and take a look.
I mean, that's really a testament to your tenacity, Deepak, that you were able to get multiple, non-medical people to come out and check out your site.
Two instances that stick to mind. I had the first insurance company that came, the chief medical officer, who was a pediatrician, came along with the head of contracting. And we were taking a tour, and I had been back and forth Zoom meetings for about 6 months. And the CMO had told me on Zoom when he heard some of the rates that I was asking for, he said, with all due respect, he said, I don't see how you have the audacity to even ask us for these rates. You are much more expensive than the hospital. And I kept telling him, no, I'm not. There are no facility fees here. But I could see that I was losing this conversation. So I stepped back and said to the CMO, I said, look, you're in, I think, Cincinnati. I said, why don't you just come? Come and take a look. I said, how many conversations like this have you had with physicians? He's like, not too many. And I said, exactly. So I said, there's a reason that I am trying to sort of educate you on this. And he said, fine, I'll come. So he came with his head of contracting and they're walking around. And he said, wow, he's like, this is like a little mini hospital. And I joked and I said, yeah, without the facility fee. And Allie, you should have seen the look on his face. It was deer in headlights. And he looks at me and then he looks at his head of contracting and he said, there's no facility fee? He said, did you know this? And I was fuming inside because I've already had these meetings with him telling him there's no facility fee. And so I'm like, you're the CMO and you don't understand. So they went back to the drawing board and came back with a better contract. And then more recently, one of the companies, I did not have a contract with them, and they're a pretty large insurer around here. And the day before they were supposed to come, I got a call from a physician saying, I have a patient here with possibly an acute DVT, and the patient is refusing to go to the ER because they don't want to wait 7-8 hours for an ultrasound. So I said, we didn't take that patient's insurance. So I said, you know what? It's okay. The patient was elderly. I said, elderly person should not be waiting, 8-9 hours. I said, you know what? Just send the patient over. And we took care of the scan. He was out in 30 minutes. And the next day when the insurance company came, I said, I had one of your patient members here. Even though I'm not on your plan, I said, it was the right thing to do. I did it for free for the patient. But I just saved your company about $10,000 even before you met me.
Hey, who can argue with that?
Yeah. I said, no ER fees. And they were like, wow, yeah, we kind of see what you're doing here. So
that's awesome. That's awesome. It's amazing how much of our practice is just educating people about what we do. And then you add this added layer of, oh, hey, we can do it in this place that's not a hospital. And it saves everybody a ton of money. And it's better for patient care. And yeah, I'm just constantly flummoxed by how many people don't understand that.
Yeah, I think especially if I would say there's one thing that vascular surgeons and cardiologists have a little step ahead of us is in most instances, they don't have to explain their specialty. But at the end of the day, I think the most important thing is really deciding for yourself that you're going to take a stand and you are going to define your worth. And you ask for more, you get less. I did not get what I asked from the insurance companies, but I definitely did better than the initial contracts that were offered to me.
That's great. That's awesome. Okay, Lori, do you work with any groups that already have existing contracts to try and improve their contracts?
I do. We will work on contract renegotiations with established groups, established practices. It's a similar process, but we typically have a lot of data, how the practice has been functioning, what their payer mix is, what the most important CPT codes are, how long the contracts have been in place. It's my experience that if a contract is fairly new, that you won't have a lot of success getting those renegotiated for 1 to 3 years. It's going to depend on what the initial term is. So that's one of the things in a contract. What is the initial term? And then they typically renew on what's called evergreen. So annually, they just renew automatically. So if we're within that time frame or outside the initial term, we can request to renegotiate those rates. There are legal clauses that allow you to do some things within that initial term if there's a problem, but those would be under the purview of a lawyer. But if we're going at it, we're going to take the data analysis. I call it a revenue assessment. We understand the important CPT codes. We understand the payer mix. We prioritize the payers and we tackle the low-hanging fruit, the most important payers to the practice, who's paying them the most, and which contracts are maybe the lowest or need the biggest improvement. And one of the things that I can't emphasize enough is that if the group took low opening offers. They just took whatever was offered when they started their practice and said, oh, we'll deal with this in a couple of years. It is very hard to make big changes to established agreements.
Yeah.
So if you've taken low opening offers, it's really hard to go back and say, oh, gosh, I know you've been paying me 85% of Medicare, but gosh, I just can't make it. And I would like 185% of Medicare. And they're like, yeah, no, like, we'll give you a 3% increase. It's really hard to make a big swing. It isn't impossible. It's very, very difficult. So I can't stress enough. And I think how important it is to do this work in the beginning, right at the start of the practice. You'll make your biggest gains as a new person joining the setting up as a group. There's so many topics, it's hard to stay narrow and think about the most important pieces. But for an established group, I think just being realistic about the gains that you can make. I think it's also important, and we spoke to it kind of or around the issue, but working within the hierarchy, as frustrating as it can be to hit those walls in the beginning, it does serve a purpose to work through the channels that have been established by the payer, as frustrating as they are, and understand that often the people that physicians end up talking to first, they don't have much decision-making authority. They maybe can make a change within 4%. Maybe they can make a change with, I'm making that number up, it's arbitrary, but maybe they can change a few things about the terms. But if you're really asking for something out of the norm or a bigger increase or a bigger amount, you're going to have to go above that person and maybe above that person. But working through those people and those established channels so that you maintain those relationships. Because once this contract's in place, your staff have to live with it. And your staff are going to be looking at those ERAs and how those claims are paying and making sure that you're getting paid on those rates that we worked really hard to get. And we want you to get paid on them to the penny. And if they're not right, if they haven't loaded your contracts right, we want your staff to have somebody that can they can call. Oh, yeah, I worked with Dr. Sudi. Great. Let's look at that contract. Let's see why it's not there. Those relationships pay off for a long time, even though it's a frustrating process in the beginning.
Okay, cool. So respect the chain of command. Got it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lori alluded to, you know, having someone in your office who really understands the contracts. I think that also brings us, I don't want to get into billing, but just one comment on that. I chose to do in-house billing. And the reason for that is I wanted to have full control and transparency over what was coming in. And having a huge third-party billing company, they're not going to be 100% invested in me in the sense of, are they going to fight for every single penny, which is what I wanted them to do. And we've seen it just in the few months that were open that my biller noticed that the patient's co-pays were $10 less. I should have been paid $40 and it was $30. And she said, okay, how many billing companies would have even cared over $10? So she called the insurance company and said, I don't think something's not right here. I think you've messed up something with Dr. Sudi's, how he's coming up in your system. And they said, no, it looks fine. It looks fine. And the $30 is correct. You shouldn't be getting $40. And she was very tenacious. She said, no, you're wrong. Your computer system is wrong. And I think they were a little taken aback. And she took it up the chain of command until I guess she couldn't take it anymore. And finally, they came back and they said, actually, you're right. We actually have him listed as a primary care physician in the national database. In Ohio, he's listed as an interventional radiologist, but this was a patient out of state. So he's listed as a primary care physician. So that's why it's showing up as $30. And I said, not only is it the $10, but the thing is, I have to do a procedure on that patient. And once I go to bill that procedure, they're going to deny it because they're going to say a primary care physician should not even be doing this procedure. So I think, you know, having that's the value that I've seen in having complete control in-house over billing.
And tackling those small problems will pay off dividends in the end, too, because when you're starting to do big cases that are in the thousands, the impact is tremendous. So making sure that those claims process correctly, that the physician is set up correctly, that the taxonomy is accurate, throughout, not only in your systems, but in their systems, because we've got a lot of we throw around the term EDI, but that electronic data interchange, how the practices computers talk to the insurance company's computers, that has to be correct all the way across, or you're going to butt up against problems that will impact claims payment.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting anecdote, and good for you for having staff that'll go to bat for you like that. That's awesome, and not give up. Lori, what other mistakes do you see doctors make other than, you know, just accepting what they get or not reading through their contracts? Is there anything that comes up over and over again where you maybe audit a practice for a renegotiation and you look through their contracts and you say, oh man, I wish that somebody had seen this ahead of time?
I think often, and this is part of when I started my own firm, that I take a more holistic approach of the revenue cycle than most people who do payer contracting. And that's making sure that we have an accurate fee schedule that is set with some logic and some defense that's in compliance with state and federal guidelines. And that is also a fee schedule that the physician feels comfortable putting out publicly.
Well, can you give me like a quick and dirty about fee schedules and the issues that you've seen with that?
So even when Dr. Sudi, he did a lot of the groundwork himself when he pulled the competitive information from the hospitals. But when we go in and do the analytics on it, even the hospitals sometimes have a charge. So the amount they charge the patient or charge the physician or the insurance company below the contracted rate. So you'll never get paid more than you charge. So you have to make sure your charges are high enough that they're higher than your highest contracted allowable. So that's a body of work I'll do with people, especially in a new practice. We're doing that together before we even start contracting. But in an established practice, we would take a look at that fee schedule that's there. And depending on what's happened to the reimbursement, what years of Medicare you're on, what year your fee schedule's on. I mean, if your fee schedule's just set to 300% of current year Medicare, well, for most IR physicians specifically, that we've seen the reimbursement go down, down, down. So then every year your charge is going down. Do you want your charges to go down? Maybe, but do it with some thought. Impacts on the self-pay fee schedule, like how much a person not using insurance, a person that is out of network, like if you have a very high fee schedule, you really are going to burden someone with a very high bill that's going to end up in their court. And it is okay for people, unfortunately, the way our healthcare system is, they're going to end up with some bills, but let's have some thought and some compliance, I guess, around how those fees are set. And so that patients aren't harmed with a disproportionately huge bill that ends up on them because perhaps the fee schedule wasn't set thoughtfully. So it is very important that a fee schedule is higher than your highest contracted allowable. And that's just a benchmark that I recommend people do. But there's other aspects to it too. It's not made in isolation, and physicians have a lot of opinions about how they want to charge and not charge, but everyone needs to be treated the same. And that foundational piece of making sure people understand that we have one charge master, we charge people the same, and this is how much we charge and why. I think understanding the fee schedule is really important.
Yeah, that does sound like a whole other topic that that a lot of folks don't know about.
Allie, does that make sense? Because it took me a while to figure out.
I think so, yeah. Well, let me see if I'm understanding it correctly. So basically, like, I mean, I know a little bit about this, but basically you set a charge for what you would do to do like a U fee or whatever, right?
Uh-huh.
And then you're contracted with this insurance company and they're going to pay you 30% or I don't know, like 150% of Medicare for it. But they already have the Medicare rate set for that CPT code, right? So then where do the charges come into play?
So there's a traditional that you bill insurance and they'll pay you about a third of what you charge. You can set your fee schedule for anything. Doesn't mean they're going to pay it. But just to make it easy, let's say you're doing that U fee, okay? And you set your charge master, let's say your maximum charge or your cash patients, okay? Is that it's going to be $1,000, okay? So if someone doesn't have insurance and they want to get a U fee from you, it would be $1,000 would be what you charge. But because they are going to pay cash and they're going to pay up front, you say, you know what? I'm going to give you a 20% discount. So it's actually going to be $800, not $1,000. Well, if you have negotiated 150% of Medicare and the insurance company, if they were to pay for the U fee, they would be paying you $1,200.
which is more, right? And well, then they'll say, well, why are we paying you $1,200 for a U fee when you will take cash $800 from a patient? And you're thinking, well, because they pay me upfront and you take a year to pay me. So I'm going to give them a little bit of discount because I get the money right now. But they're going to come back and say, well, you know what? If you're willing to accept $800 for a U fee, even though it's cash, we're going to knock down your reimbursement to $800.
Okay.
So that means with the discount, your cash rate should be above $1,200 because that's your maximum across all the insurance companies if that was your best contract.
I see. Okay. Yeah, no, that's a really good example that makes me understand it a lot better.
On the U fee side, though, that's a little confusing just because your U fee is probably $20,000.
Yeah.
Not a thousand.
Right, sure, right, sure, no, sure. We were we were talking in Monopoly money right there.
Yeah.
Make the math easy, because just remember that in Site of Service 11, you're billing a global fee. You're billing the entire fee, where when we're in an ambulatory surgery center or a hospital, you're getting the work RVU goes to the physician, practice expense is going to the facility. So in your Site of Service 11, you're negotiating for that entire fee.
I do have a question from the audience. One of our co-hosts, Don Garbett, asked this question. He wanted to know a little bit if you have experience with carve-outs for things that are usually in the ambulatory surgery center, like, for example, pain procedures. Does anybody have carve-outs for that, or what's the best way to go about that, or is it just impossible?
It is not impossible. I think, and that's part of when you do that initial revenue assessment with a practice, is understanding what is unique about them and their site of service and what they're doing. And typically in a Site of Service 11, you are not compensated separately for devices. So understanding your break even, understanding your cost, what goes into those cases, and how much you need to make to break even, and how much you need to make a profit. And when a contract is established, there are terms in there and language in there that define every single reimbursement thing. So if you're doing one that I'm more familiar with carving out in the OBL is the Y90. And if you're doing Y90 and you don't have that specifically carved out, meaning added to your contract and defined how they will pay it, you will end up typically, it's either going to deny completely, because if you think about the claim coming in, it hits your contract electronically. If you think about the claim coming in, hits your contract, this really expensive Y90 is on there, and there's no CPT code to match it up to with a fee, if that makes sense. Or it defaults into a bucket where maybe you've said, okay, drugs, biologicals, in office, anything administered in the office will take 20% of CMS. Oh boy. That would be bad. And that happens to people. So be careful about the default language. It's really important not to add specific procedures like that could get covered under default language. If you're going to have a unique niche in your business or in your practice, regardless of what specialty you are, make sure before you sign any agreement how that will be compensated. Or it could really put you in a financially compromising position. Very, very risky position if those kinds of things aren't addressed in contracting. So personally, I help people work through that in the very beginning, and we try and make sure we've identified, even if that vision to add those unique things is 5 years down the line, try and get those negotiated in the contracts right up front so that they're ready to go as they bring those new service lines, those new businesses, or those new providers on deck online.
Awesome. Well, we're about wrapping up on our hour here. Any final words of advice for our audience? Deepak, I'll start with you.
I think when you are opening up an OBL or ASC, you really have to think about not only the types of procedures that you are doing, but really think about what makes you unique to the community, because you have to be able to articulate that uniqueness to the insurance companies. And then secondly, really try to negotiate with them. One of the things that Lori told me, she said, if I told a physician to delay opening by 6 months just to negotiate an insurance contract, how many people would take my advice?
And I told her, I said, probably unless someone is like really mega loaded and has just money sitting around to, you know, for just to sit there for 6 months, I said, maybe that person. And she said, exactly. But it wasn't by choice that I kind of sat around. I just wasn't on the plans. I probably could have gotten on the plans within a couple months if I just took what they gave me. But I said, this is my financial livelihood, and this is going to set the tone for the next 25, 30 years.
All right. Yeah. Lori, any last words of advice?
Yeah. I would say to anybody, don't give away your signature authority. Retain that signature authority. Don't let people sign on your behalf. Understand what you're signing and why. Understand your obligations under your agreements. This is your paycheck. Put the time in to understand how much money they're offering you. If it's a proprietary fee schedule, get that proprietary fee schedule and understand what it means before you agree to it. Negotiate, negotiate, negotiate. And I think keep your head up. Don't focus so much on your own business, but kind of look around and look at other businesses in the market, what's happening. Medicare Advantage and small rural hospitals is something I've been really emphasizing to my IR clients and OBL owners. I'm like, look at what's happening to rural hospitals with Medicare Advantage. I find personally that OBL owners have a similar exposure, a similar risk, and understanding kind of what's happening out there outside of you and how that can apply to your business so that you're proactive, you're ahead of it. If you're keeping an eye on your payer mix and making sure that you've got a nice payer mix so that if something challenging happens with one payer, that it isn't like half your income, that you've got some diversification to minimize your risk, your exposure. So we talked a lot of complicated topics today, and I feel like we barely touched the surface, but I hope everybody took away just really some important things about the difference in enrollment and credentialing and contracting and being the best advocate you can be for yourself and your business and getting those rates up front. I can't stress that enough.
Lori, Deepak, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you again for having us.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us @_backtable on Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Backtable is produced and hosted by myself, Aaron Fritz, and co-hosts
Chris Beck,
Sabine Dong,
Michael Barraza,
and Ali Behetti.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles, Nick Shellcross,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz.
Social media and PR by Ann Dang,
Manisha Naganathanahalli,
and Manveer Singh Subli.
Administrative support provided by Jamila Kinnebrew.
Intro and extra music is Ripperoo by Skeptic Moon. Find us on Spotify or at local live music venues in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Thanks again for listening.